From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, the prominent Christian Lebanese cabinet minister, Pierre Gemayel, was gunned down in Beirut. He was a leading opponent of Syria, and while many suspect a Syrian hand in his death, Syria has denied any role. The killing has exacerbated tensions in what was an already worsening political situation in Lebanon. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Nicholas Blandford, Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and author of Killing Mr. Lebanon, about the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Hariri's assassination led to the Cedar Revolution, but Blandford says the optimism of the revolution has faded. Also, we remember the jazz singer Anita O'Day. She died last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nicholas Blanford, has been reporting from Lebanon for over 10 years. He's the Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, the Times of London, and the Lebanon Daily Star. Last week, Pierre Jamil, a minister in the government, was assassinated. He was a member of the Christian Falangist Party and an opponent of Syrian involvement in his country's politics. Syria is widely believed to be behind his murder. Several Lebanese politicians and journalists who spoke out against Syria have been assassinated in the past couple of years. The former prime minister, Rafik Hariri, was assassinated in February 2005. Nicholas Blanford has written a new book about the larger implications of Hariri's assassination, called Killing Mr. Lebanon. After Hariri's assassination, tens of thousands of Lebanese people took to the streets in a series of anti-Syrian demonstrations. These protests, which became known as the Cedar Revolution, led to the withdrawal of Syria's troops from Lebanon. I spoke with Blanford, who was in the BBC studio in Beirut, and asked if there's any optimism left from the Cedar Revolution.
I think the optimism faded a long time ago, to be honest. The Cedar Revolution was, I mean, an amazing event and a real credit to the Lebanese. It was quite unparalleled in the Arab world. But it wasn't the sort of revolution of national unity that some of its leaders were describing it as at the time, because, of course, the Shia weren't there. This was essentially a grouping of Christians and Sunnis and Druze, minus the Shia, who remained more or less pro-Syrian. After the Syrians left in April of last year, under pressure from the Cedar Revolution and international pressure, it was back to the same old politicking amongst Lebanon's politicians. There had been a sense, rather naively, I guess, that the Cedar Revolution was so unprecedented that it was going to be a real jolt to the political system here, that it would allow for a new generation of politicians to come through. And of course, that didn't happen. It was very much the same old faces that were re-elected to the Lebanese parliament. And since then, Lebanon has been mired in a political crisis of varying intensity. And of course, we're going through a very major political crisis now, perhaps the most serious crisis since the end of the 1975-1990 civil war. And that, of course, doesn't lead for a great deal of optimism.
Well, Hezbollah was calling for huge street demonstrations. In support of Hezbollah, Hezbollah wants more power within the Lebanese government. Those demonstrations were postponed out of respect for Pierre Jamil's death. What exactly does Hezbollah want from these demonstrations?
I see these demonstrations, or these planned demonstrations, and indeed Hezbollah's entire political gambit over the past month or so, as a defensive gesture. If you like, offense being the best form of defense. And the reason for that is that although Hezbollah fought a very good war in the summer against Israel, and their military wing gave the Israelis, frankly, a bloody nose, but they have emerged from the war weaker in some respects than before they entered it. They've lost their military autonomy in South Lebanon along the border with Israel. All the bunkers and so on that they set up over the past 6 years have gone. There's a reinforced UN peacekeeping force down there, 15,000 Lebanese troops. So Hezbollah has turned its attention more to a political offensive. And this is really designed to prevent the Western-backed Lebanese government from putting more pressure on Hezbollah, possibly leading to the disarming of Hezbollah's military wing, the dismantling of its military wing, which Hezbollah is adamant that it's not going to do. It wants to block legislation that could see an expansion of the powers of the UN peacekeeping force in South Lebanon, and to block any legislation passed by the Lebanese government that could be perceived as a threat or detrimental not only to Hezbollah's interests, but the interests of its allies, Syria and Iran.
Do you feel like you're seeing the beginning of a new civil war in Lebanon?
Not necessarily. A lot of people are trying to compare the current situation with the period in the early 70s before war broke out in 1975. And there are some parallels that can be drawn, but there are also a lot of differences. And one is that I think that the Lebanese collectively still have a very strong memory of the civil war. It ended 16 years ago now, but it remains ingrained very deeply in the psyche of the Lebanese. It was, of course, a terrible event that lasted 16 years, and you don't just erase that overnight. So I think that there is a check, a break, if you like, that although one gets a sense that the situation could be slipping out of control, even the most strident of politicians are putting on the brakes just a little bit, thinking, well, we don't want to go too far. The last thing we want to do is to resume the civil war. Also, just from the practicality side of perspective, back in the early 70s, all the main political parties, or most of the main political parties and factions, split along sectarian lines, were armed to the teeth. They'd all formed private militias, be they the Christians. The Sunnis had their own private militias and were allied with the Palestinians, who were an army back then in Lebanon. And the Shia started arming themselves. Now you've basically got Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is not just a militia. It's a very formidable military force, essentially like a conventional infantry brigade. And there's no way that even the Lebanese army could take on Hezbollah, let alone any fledgling militia that might be under formation now, which doesn't really seem to be the case anyway. So just from that perspective alone, it would be difficult to actually fight a civil war where you'd be pitching militia against militia in the way that you had back in the early stages of the civil war in 75 and 76.
Has Hezbollah been fulfilling its promise to help Lebanese people rebuild their homes and help them find temporary housing in the interim?
Yeah, it was very quick off the mark after the war, when the Lebanese government was still wondering what to do with all the aid money that had begun to pour in. Hezbollah very quickly set up a system of payment to everybody who'd lost homes. They were paying $12,000 cash to people in the southern suburbs of Beirut, which was very heavily bombed during the war, and to people who'd lost their apartments and homes, and $10,000 cash to people who'd lost their homes living outside Beirut. And this was essentially to buy some furniture and tide them over, paying rent for a year while their homes were rebuilt. So this was a good, I mean, obviously it was a hearts and minds effort, and it was a successful one, I think, as well. Since then, we've seen there was almost like a war of aid in the first couple of months after the war. So you had Hezbollah, and of course backed by Iran, handing out handfuls of cash, literally, to all these people. And then you had the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the Qataris, all Sunni countries, piling into South Lebanon, offering to rebuild entire villages at a time. And the Hezbollah officials tend to give a bit of a rueful chuckle and a shrug of the shoulders and say, well, you know, this is politics, and if they're willing to step in and, you know, give us millions of dollars to rebuild our homes, then so be it, regardless of who they are.
And how much progress is being made in rebuilding that part?
Well, they've been quite quick in clearing all the rubble away. I mean, it was really quite an astonishing sight. I spent the war down in the south, and so I didn't see any of this until after the ceasefire. But to walk down streets, which I know quite well in the southern suburbs, where I've interviewed many Hezbollah officials over the years, and it had all gone. They were just reduced to piles of rubble, maybe, you know, like Berlin after World War II. And they've been very quick in carting all this rubble away, and the collapsed buildings are now essentially holes in the ground awaiting development. It's going to take 2, maybe 3 years before the area is rebuilt and up and functioning.
And do you see UN troops in the streets? Do they have a visible presence?
Not in Beirut. The UN peacekeeping troops, the UNIFIL, are based in South Lebanon, essentially south of the Litani River, which roughly runs around 15 to 20 miles north of the border. So the UN presence down there is very dense. I mean, they're all over the place now. The old UNIFIL, the UNIFIL that had been there since 1978, there were 2,000 peacekeepers before the war started. They've now gone up to about 9,000. They had got to know the situation in South Lebanon, and they had a very sort of laid-back, relaxed attitude. I mean, they were still doing their job as, you know, UN observers and peacekeepers, of course, but they interacted with the local community extremely well. And that is quite interesting to see the influx of new troops, particularly troops from France and Spain and Italy, that form the bulk of this new force. And they've come in with a sense that we are here as a robust peacekeeping force. We're not here, of course, to physically disarm Hezbollah, but we want to show the UN flag, and we're not going to take any trouble from anybody. So they've been charging around in these newly white-painted tanks and armored personnel carriers. And the local people don't like that. They don't like foreign troops charging around their little villages. And I think it'll take a little while until some of these fresh troops realize that peacekeeping in Lebanon is done a little differently, and that, you know, you should take off the helmet and put on the beret and remove the sunglasses and go and chat to people and see how they're doing. And it's the friendly face. And if they do that, they'll win the locals to their side immediately.
My guest is Nicholas Blanford, Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and author of the new book, Killing Mr. Lebanon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholas Blanford. He's the Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and author of the new book, Killing Mr. Lebanon, The Assassination of Rafiq Hariri and Its Impact on the Middle East. Rafiq Hariri, the former prime minister of Lebanon, was assassinated last year. Last week, Pierre Jamil, who was a government minister, was assassinated. We recently had on Fresh Air a Lebanese journalist named May Shijak, who there was an assassination attempt on her life. Her car was bombed while she was in it, and she lost an arm and a leg. Everybody seems to believe there's like a hit list and that more people are targeted and that the Syrians are behind it. What kind of effect is that having on the political life and the journalistic life in Lebanon? Because it seems to be journalists and people in politics who are being primarily targeted.
Yeah, that's right. I would say almost crippling effect. I've been talking to a number of politicians since Jamil's assassination, and indeed after previous assassinations. And the thing is that nobody really knows who's going to be next. Some of the choices of those the targets have been peculiar choices. May Shijak, for one, a very respected journalist, very courageous journalist, but no one would have necessarily thought that she would have been targeted for assassination, and she was extremely lucky to survive, and a very brave woman, having come through her ordeal. And there were some other politicians. There was one called Georges Haoui, and he was a former head of the Communist Party, who used to be close to Syria, but had sort of shifted ranks. But he was seen as a veteran politician who's perhaps, you know, past his prime, close to retirement, and he was blown up in June of last year. And I think that to a certain extent, this has heightened the fear. There are the obvious targets, of course, the leaders of the anti-Syrian movement, if you like. But although they take precautions, you have a sort of a second tier and a third tier of politicians and journalists who now feel as threatened as the first tier. So yes, I mean, I talked to one politician the other day who's an MP, a parliamentarian from northern Lebanon, and he was saying, look, I don't really have the money for a major protection. I can't drive around in armored cars. I just have to be careful. I can't afford bodyguards. I look over my shoulder the whole time. He said, if I wasn't living under this threat, you would hear a lot more of me in public, but I have to tone it down. I'm getting my friends are calling me all the time saying, be careful, don't speak out too much, don't draw attention to yourself. And I think that a lot of parliamentarians and cabinet ministers and journalists, you know, are extremely worried, and of course, with the events of the nearly past 2 years, with good reason.
Nicholas Blanford, your new book, Killing Mr. Lebanon, is about the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The UN is investigating the assassination. The assumption is that Syria was behind it. Why would Syria possibly have wanted to assassinate Hariri?
Well, I describe in the introduction that the story of Hariri and the Syrians was a Shakespearean tragedy of misunderstanding. And I described it thus because Hariri was never an enemy of Syria. Hariri was a compromiser. He was an appeaser. He was a businessman. He had a vision for Lebanon, a rather altruistic vision of Lebanon being independent, sovereign, free of Israeli occupation and free of Syrian domination. He was an Arab nationalist. He'd been an Arab nationalist since his teenage years and had an affinity with Syria and with the Arab cause, the Palestinian cause. And he was also pragmatic enough to know that that Syria was just a fact of life for Lebanon. And he tried from 2000 onwards, when Bashar al-Assad became president of Syria, he tried to accommodate the Syrians, reaching out to the Syrians to tell the Syrians that, look, basically, I'm a friend of yours. I'm going to act in your interests. The only thing is that I can't continue operating the way we are when I have a Syrian military intelligence general calling me up every day, telling me what to do. Now, the thing is that Hariri came into confrontation with the specifically friends of Bashar al-Assad and this younger generation that took over in Damascus in 2000. Hariri was friends with the older generation, the generation of Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, who had been president of Syria since 1970, I think. So Hariri found himself sort of out of favor of the new crowd that had shown up in Damascus and their allies in Lebanon. So he was trying to reach out to the Syrians, but at the same time, his enemies in Lebanon were whispering to the Syrians, saying, don't trust him. He's a powerful Sunni. He's with the West. He's with America. He's with France. He's trying to undermine you. And it was an intensely frustrating period for him. And eventually, he felt that it's just not working. My message is not getting through to the Syrians. I'm getting weaker and weaker. And he began slowly to shift into the existing Lebanese opposition to Syrian domination, which essentially was geared around the Christians and the Druze communities. And there was a great, very strong feeling of foreboding and fear, indeed, in the Hariri camp at the beginning of 2005. And, of course, Hariri was killed on St. Valentine's Day. And this was seen as a bold, decisive move by the Syrians to remove this very serious threat, this guy who potentially could weaken Syria's hold on Lebanon. You remove him from the scene and hopefully cow the Lebanese opposition at the time. Of course, it had completely the opposite effect. It was a catalyst for what became the Cedar Revolution. And within 2 months of Hariri's death, the Syrians had disengaged from Lebanon.
You actually heard the explosion that killed Hariri and other members of his convoy. Would you recall for us what happened that day?
Yes. Actually, that morning I had driven past the Saint-Georges Hotel with my family to go and check out a potential school for my children. And I got back home late morning, and I was working at my desk, and I was actually on the phone to someone who's on the other side of Beirut when there was this enormous blast. Loudest blast I've heard in Beirut. And we do occasionally hear loud bangs in Beirut from the sonic booms of low-flying Israeli jets. And this is what I and most people assumed it was. And particularly as the person that I was talking to, who's on the other side of Beirut, also heard the explosion. So I assumed that this must be a sonic boom and not just something local down my street, a gas bottle exploding or something like that. So I grabbed my camera and notebook and ran out the door and jumped in the car and raced down towards the center of town, which is only about 5 minutes' drive away. And, of course, as I was leaving my neighborhood, I could see this huge plume of black smoke climbing into the sky. And I thought perhaps an aeroplane had crashed at first. And then I arrived at the scene and parked up the car and ran down. It was obvious immediately that it was a bomb blast. There were huge clumps of asphalt from the road that had been blown 300 yards. I parked about 400 or 500 yards away and ran the rest of the way to the bomb site. And I was having to jump over these massive clumps of earth and masonry and asphalt from the road before actually getting to the scene. And it was quite astonishing because, I mean, I'd driven just along there a couple of hours earlier with my family. And then suddenly to see a scene that looked like something out of Baghdad on a bad day, with this enormous crater in the road. I mean, it really took the breath away, a huge hole. And it was surrounded by troops, of course, and police and burnt out cars and people covered in blood and panic stricken and so on. But it was in fact a friend of mine, a photographer, who was the first on the scene after the bombing. He came up to me and said it was Hariri, and he'd seen Hariri's body, burnt body, and recognized some of the bodyguards. So it came as a complete shock, of course. I mean, you know, my reaction was the same as most Lebanese. It was a stunning, stunning moment to have this guy that was known as Mr. Lebanon, who dominated the politics and economics of post-Civil War Lebanon, to you know, have him a burnt body lying on the road next to a smoking crater and burning cars.
Nicholas Blanford speaking to us from the BBC in Beirut. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. His new book is called Killing Mr. Lebanon, The Assassination of Rafiq Hariri and Its Impact on the Middle East. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of A Military Miscellany, Important, Uncommon, and Sometimes Forgotten Facts and Stories from America's Military History by Thomas Ayers. And from Patricia Papper for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The red light's on.
Coming up, we remember jazz singer Anita O'Day and listen back to a 1987 interview. She died last week. Also, more with Nicholas Blanford. He'll tell us why he sees the recent war between Israel and Hezbollah as a struggle between the U.S. and Iran for control of the Middle East. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nicholas Blanford, the Beirut correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's covered Lebanon for over 10 years. His new book, Killing Mr. Lebanon, is about the assassination last year of the former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri and its impact on the Middle East. His assassination led to the Cedar Revolution, in which tens of thousands of Lebanese people took to the streets in a series of anti-Syrian demonstrations that led Syria to withdraw its troops from Lebanon. Why do you think that Hariri's assassination became such a turning point in Lebanon?
A number of reasons. First of all, you don't kill someone like Rafiq Hariri, quite frankly. He was too big. He's too powerful. There have been lots of assassinations in Lebanon before, during the Civil War years. Presidents, prime ministers, political leaders, leading religious clerics. But none of them had the stature of Hariri, not because of Hariri's position so much as the Prime Minister of Lebanon, although he's a former Prime Minister, of course, by the time he was killed. But he had enormous clout internationally. He was a close friend of Jacques Chirac. He used to visit the White House all the time. Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan was a close friend. He had enormous clout in the Arab world, of course. He was a close friend and advisor to Ayad Alawi, who was the then Prime Minister of Iraq. Very close to the Saudi royal family, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. This was an international figure. He wasn't just a Lebanese politician. So by killing Hariri, particularly as he'd been under threat of death, and the Syrians had been warned, of course, by numerous sources in the weeks and months before Hariri's assassination, do not kill Rafiq Hariri. That is, you'll be crossing a red line. He was assassinated anyway, and of course the immediate assumption was that it was the Syrians. But I think also because the situation in Lebanon at the time was becoming increasingly polarized, this whole idea of Syria's dominion over Lebanon was the hot political subject. The UN Security Council, the previous September, had issued a resolution 1559, which was a very blunt demand that Syria leave Lebanon. And this was an extremely controversial resolution in Lebanon and dominated the media and the political discourse, as well as the whole, the growing mobilization momentum by the opposition in preparation for the parliamentary elections. So it's almost like all this tension was building up like a pressure cooker. And then Hariri's assassination sort of was the moment that the valve was released, and all this pent-up pressure came bursting out in the form of the Cedar Revolution.
You know, it seems like such a paradox. The Cedar Revolution demands that Syria get out of Lebanon's politics. Syria, withdraws from Lebanon. But then in elections, Hezbollah gains more seats in parliament. And, of course, after the war with Israel, Hezbollah emerges with a newfound, power and respect from a lot of Lebanese. And Hezbollah is, of course, aligned with Syria. So in the post-Cedar Revolution era, does Syria in some ways still have as much influence as it did before because of Hezbollah's power?
Well, it doesn't have as much influence as before, that's for sure. But it does still wield considerable influence through Hezbollah and various other Lebanese allies. Hezbollah, I think that part of the way of looking at this is that Hezbollah sees itself as part of this anti-Western alliance of Iran and Syria and Hezbollah, and it feels that it's acting not as a tool, if you like, of Damascus, but it feels that it has shared interests with Damascus and with Iran, and it acts within that context. So it's not necessarily, it's still an extremely popular organization on a grassroots level with the Shia community, even though, and it should be remembered, that a lot of Shia had no love for Syria. The 1 million or so Syrian laborers that used to work in Lebanon were stealing jobs effectively from the Shia, which remains one of the poorer communities in Lebanon, although albeit perhaps the largest. So, but the Shia do view Hezbollah as the protector of the community, the champion of its interests, and that has helped quell some dissatisfaction in some Shia quarters about Hezbollah's ties to Syria and its sort of military campaign against Israel, which of course resulted in devastation in mainly Shia parts of the country, the southern suburbs of Beirut and South Lebanon. But the Shia recognize Hezbollah as their protector, their guarantor of their rights, and so they're sticking with Hezbollah, which is, I think, that is the root of Hezbollah's power. If Hezbollah was seen simply as a pro-Syrian entity that had no real grassroots support, then Hezbollah would be marginalized immediately. It would effectively cease to exist.
You report from Beirut, and I'm wondering if you see Lebanon as an indicator of what's happening in the larger region.
Well, I think you certainly have Lebanon. Lebanon is today perhaps one of the main battlegrounds for control of the Middle East. You obviously have one in Iraq. But with Lebanon, Lebanon has always had this role, and I think it boils down to the fact that there is no one community in Lebanon that's large enough and strong enough to dominate all the others. So the communities here have a tendency to look for outside support to bolster their domestic position. So you have a government that is ostensibly backed by the United States and France, supported by chiefly Sunni states in the region, like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt. And then on the other hand, you have Hezbollah, which is the spearhead of the pro-Syrian opposition here. And Hezbollah, of course, is part of this alliance with Syria and Iran and like-minded pro-Syrian Palestinian groups and so on. You can strip away all the local detail, if you like, and boil it down to a confrontation between Iran and the United States for control, no less, of the Middle East. It's really big-stake stuff. And indeed, the war that we had this summer between Hezbollah and Israel was part of that same conflict. So you had the United States and Iran fighting a war using two local proxies, Hezbollah and Israel, and Lebanon as the battleground. So this is the sad reality for Lebanon, and this is why I think many Lebanese feel that the situation is beyond their control, and they have a sense that it doesn't matter what we do, what we say, our strings are being pulled by much larger powers, and we have no choice either to put up with it or pack our bags and leave, which unfortunately many Lebanese are so doing.
So you saw Israel as the proxy for the United States in the war over the summer?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that certainly many Lebanese saw, in some respects, Israel as the slightly hesitant partner and the United States pushing Israel to continue the campaign against Hezbollah. Because from my perspective, and I was up in the sort of the front line, as it were, so it was a fairly local perspective down in South Lebanon, but the war was not prosecuted at all well by Israel. For 6 years, we've been listening to the Israelis saying to Hezbollah, after every little incident along the border, the Israelis would say, look, if you do this again, we're really going to get mad. This is your last chance. You're playing with fire. And Hezbollah didn't believe it, of course. They had this balance of terror that they felt that Israel wouldn't go too far in retaliating to whatever Hezbollah did along the border, because Israel was scared of Hezbollah's enormous arsenal of rockets being unleashed on northern Israel. And it seems that Hezbollah bought into this this theory a little too far. So when they kidnapped the two soldiers, they crossed a red line without knowing it. And so the Israelis reacted, and in an extreme way, bombing the southern suburbs of Beirut and sending in troops across the border. But nonetheless, it was a very hesitant campaign, and it fell into Hezbollah's hands to a certain extent. You know, they were doing these hesitant little probes across the border, testing Hezbollah's defenses, rather than perhaps the bolder move right at the beginning of the war that might have had a more decisive edge over Hezbollah in the longer run. And we got this sense that, you know, the Americans, for all their backing of the Lebanese government, largely dropped the Lebanese government during this war. And I think Condoleezza Rice called it the birth pangs of the new Middle East. And I can tell you that many Lebanese didn't particularly think that was an apt description for the billions of dollars worth of destruction in Lebanon and over 1,000 civilians killed. But that was nonetheless the feeling in Lebanon, that this was the Americans pushing Israel, encouraging Israel to prosecute their campaign against Hezbollah, for the reason partly to see how a campaign can be fought against Hezbollah in light of a possible military strike against Iran. The war this summer can be seen in those terms as well.
It was reported this week that Hezbollah has been training members of the Mahdi army in Iraq. This is the Iranian Shiite militia led by Muqtada al-Sadr. And I'm wondering what you know about that.
I treat these reports with a degree of skepticism. It's certainly plausible. Hezbollah, of course, is extremely closely allied to Iran. It is a component of Iranian foreign policy. And it has certainly trained up Palestinians during the course of the Al-Aqsa Intifada since 2000, over the past 6 years. And this is really specialist training, the use of explosives, anti-tank missiles, things like that, training that can be done on a small scale pretty much an ad hoc basis in remoter areas of the Bekaa Valley, which is in the eastern Lebanon, close to the border with Syria. There is no way that Hezbollah is capable or can undertake in Lebanon mass training of militiamen in terms where you'd have sort of big training camps, because this country is very, very small. There are Israeli aircraft flying around in Lebanese airspace all the time, taking pictures and flying reconnaissance patrols and looking out for exactly this sort of thing. So it's possible that Hezbollah could have taken, I think the report said that there were around 1,000, 1,200 Mehdi Army militiamen had come to Lebanon in dribs and drabs and been trained up in various military skills. But I do question a little bit why the Mehdi Army would have to come to Lebanon for this sort of training when they're bang next door to Iran. And of course, it was the Iranians that trained up Hezbollah in the first place. And given that this is a very small country, Lebanon, and that you have so much surveillance and reconnaissance and attention focused on this country, I'm not sure why they would take the risk of transferring these people over to Lebanon for training when it seems to me that they could be trained in complete secrecy and privacy in Iran, bang next door to Iraq. So I treat these sort of reports with skepticism. And I've been to Iraq, not for a couple of years now, but on previous tours there in 2003, 2004. I did look quite closely into the reports that were circulating then of Hezbollah involvement in Iraq, and they either came out to be verifiably false or just really sort of lacked any real integrity. So I'm not saying it's not true, but I'm just a little bit skeptical.
Well, Nicholas Blanford, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, you're welcome.
Nicholas Blanford speaking to us from the BBC in Beirut. His new book is called Killing Mr. Lebanon, The Assassination of Rafiq Hariri and Its Impact on the Middle East. The jazz singer Anita O'Day died last week. Coming up, we listen back to a 1987 interview with her. This is Fresh Air. The jazz singer Anita O'Day died last week of a heart attack at the age of 87. The music critic Will Friedwald has described her as, quote, always the greatest, the coolest, the hippest, and the swinginest. She completely changed the definition of what it meant to be a big band singer. The band could play it as fast, as tricky, as loud, as rhythmically supercharged as they wanted, and they would never lose O'Day, unquote. Anita O'Day first became known in 1941 when she joined the Gene Krupa Band. She later sang with Stan Kenton, Benny Goodman, and many small groups. In her 1981 autobiography, High Times, Hard Times, O'Day explained that her last name was Colton, but she changed it to O'Day because in Pig Latin that meant dough, and she hoped to make plenty of it. Unfortunately, most of the money she did make from her records and concerts went into her arm. She had always been a hard drinker, but in 1954 she started using heroin. It wasn't until 15 years later that she kicked the habit. Before we hear the interview I recorded with her, here she is in 1959 with a band led by Jimmy Giuffre.
I will feel a glow just thinking of you, just the way you look tonight. Lovely, with your smile so warm and your cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you, just the way you look tonight. With each word, your tenderness grows, tearing my fears apart, and the smile that wrinkles your nose clutches my foolish heart. Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breath a spark. Won't you please arrange it for a lot of you? Just the way you look tonight.
I spoke with Anita O'Day in 1987.
throughout your career, you've always not wanted to be the, quote, girl singer, the person who's accompanied by the band, accompanied by the orchestra. You've always said you wanted your voice to be part of the band.
Right.
Would you explain some of the things that you did and didn't want as a singer with a band?
Well, the things I did want was to be there, because you learn and you earn while you learn. Nothing wrong with that one. The band work is really very simple work. It's called pattern work. And you mostly sing quarter notes, and the band fills with patterns. Pleasure, you're about. The band goes, do-wah. You know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
So it's called pattern work. And then, after Gene Krupa Orchestra for 5 years and Stan Kenton for 1 year, this is a few years back, I decided that I would like to try for a small group, which is different kind of work.
You have a very unique voice, and physically, one of the reasons for part of the uniqueness of your singing is that you don't have a uvula.
You read my book.
I did read your book. Can you tell us about how you lost your uvula? And I should say that that's the little fleshy overhang in the back of your mouth.
That hangs down in the back of the throat when you see the cartoons and it shows her singing and that little thing's going, ah, well, that's gone. I was in the hospital for just regular bit of tonsils or something. I think it was 7 years old, and my mother said, years later, I said, you know, I want to be a singer, and I've really got a problem. I can't get any vibration going. I have to make a different type. And that's when she told me about this uvula having been, it was a slip of the knife.
During the tonsillectomy?
Yeah, during the, tonsillectomy, right.
So
that's how that went down.
How did that change your singing?
Well, not knowing about it from 7 years old and not knowing I was going to be singing at 20 and still singing at 68 years old, it didn't make much difference because you find a way to do it, because where there's a will, you know.
When you were singing with big bands, you were usually the only woman in the band. And I think it was always a source of pride for you that you could, you know, keep up with the men in every way. In your book, you wrote that you were proud that you carried your own bags, you paid your own checks when you were with the Krupa band.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, I sort of became one of the guys because that was the only way to play it, you know? I mean, I guess you could play it girl, but I haven't played girl yet. Let's see, I'm 68. I'm going to play girl next year because I'm always too busy.
What does playing girl mean to you?
Just that. You know, you wear girl's clothes and you don't pick up your own bags. I've been wearing slacks since 1932.
I want to play the first really big hit that you have, play an excerpt of it. This was... you recorded this in 1941 with Roy Eldridge.
With Roy, yeah, I do it every night. Yes, I call it my nostalgia portion, and I do Let Me Off Uptown.
What's the story behind the record? How did you get to do a duet on this?
Oh, I have no idea. Gene bought it from somebody who made the arrangement and taught us how to do it.
And
it belonged to Gene. It was in his books.
The record sold, I think, 1.5 million copies?
That's the one Gene bought a house in Yonkers. Yeah, that's right.
Well, let's play an excerpt of it. This is my guest Anita O'Day, is recorded in 1941.
Right.
Hey, Joe.
What do you mean, Joe? My name's Roy.
Well, come here, Roy, and get groovy. You been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown, but I've been around.
You mean to say you ain't been uptown?
No, I ain't been uptown. What's uptown?
If it's pleasure you're about, and you feel like stepping out, all you've got to shout is, let me off uptown. If it's rhythm that you feel, then it's nothing to conceal. All you've got to spill is, let me off uptown. Rib joints, juke joints, hip joints. Where could a fella go to top it? If you want to pitch a ball and you can't afford a hall, all you've got to call is, let me off uptown.
Anita, oh Anita, say I feel something.
What you feel, Roy? The heat?
No, it must be that uptown rhythm. I feel like blowing.
Well, blow, Roy, blow.
low.
Nita O'Day, how did that record change your life?
Well, it didn't change it too quickly because at that time there was no union for girl singers. I made $7.50.
From a million and a half selling record?
That's right. He built a house in Yonkers.
My goodness.
We're listening to a 1987 interview with Anita O'Day. She died last week at the age of 87. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. The jazz singer Anita O'Day died last week at the age of 87. Let's get back to our 1987 interview with her.
You played with several other big band leaders in addition to Krupa. You performed briefly with Benny Goodman, and you described him as a band leader who always tried to distract attention from the performer so that they wouldn't take attention away from him?
Yeah, well, that was just his style. I don't think he did it maliciously. That was just his way.
How would he do it?
Well, for instance, if I've scheduled to do four tunes and the people are giving me too much attention, he would just automatically go into Sing, 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 which is his tune, and I'd have to leave the stage waving goodbye. Yeah.
You've had a lot of hard drinking in your time, and you've also done a lot of drugs in your time. Do you think that your involvement with alcohol and drugs had anything to do with wanting to keep up with the men, as we were talking about before, and wanting to be as...
That's
tough
a good
as
question.
They were.
Never thought about it that way. No, I do it because I enjoy it. You know, everybody has their things, and that's what I do. You know, I didn't want to have a family. I didn't want to sit at home. I didn't want to be a housewife and own property, and I didn't want to work in an office from 9 to 5. And so I was just out there looking to find something that I could, like, go along with, you know, and maybe contribute to the people in the world.
You were convicted several times on drug charges. How difficult did that make it for you to get bookings in certain cities that had...
It helped. That's showbiz. They come to look at the girl that went to jail for smoking dope. I don't say that happens today because it's too popular today and the kids grew up and they say, well, that's a scam, you know. But at that time, that was part of it, man. I'd work a club and they'd be standing out down the street around the corner getting in to see the girl just get out of jail.
So it just didn't matter for you when you were hooked?
I worked all the time.
Uh-huh. Did people know?
Everybody knew. I worked those kind of places.
Well, did it affect your performance? I mean, could you tell?
I don't know. I just did it. I was asked to do 50 minutes. I do 50 minutes. That was my job.
How did you finally kick after?
Oh, I went to Hawaii. I went to Hawaii, and I didn't know anybody in Hawaii. And when you get the chills, I just laid in the hot sun. And when you get the sweats, I jumped in the water. I did it for 5 months, cool, cold, and straight ever since.
Did you have to almost relearn how to sing straight after you'd been performing high for so many years?
Yeah, you kind of have to work around it, right. That's why I went back to the nostalgia things, because I'd been doing bebop and whatever else. And so I went back to before that time, and that's what I'm doing now.
I recently had the opportunity to see a movie that I suspect a lot of our listeners have seen, Jazz on a Summer's Day, mm-hmm. which was a performance at the Newport Jazz Festival.
Oh, I was feeling no pain that day.
Really?
This is what... I was on 60 Minutes, and Harry Reasoner asked me the same thing. He says, that day when you were on Jazz on a Summer's Day, and you were out there in that big picture hat, and the breeze was blowing those real ostrich feathers on top of it, he says to me, were you high? And I looked at him, and I looked back at the little film they were showing me, and I says, I would say yes.
Well, you know what I really wanted to know was how you were wearing these great white gloves in it, these, like, I think wrist-high white gloves, and it's very sharp-looking. I don't know how many women were actually wearing those gloves back in 1958, but how did you decide to wear them? I think it almost became a trademark.
Well, I went to George Wein, who was the promoter of the whole thing, and I said, what night am I on? Because it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights. And he says to me, oh, you're on Sunday afternoon. And I said, oh, thanks a lot. You know, what am I going to wear on a Sunday afternoon? I'm not going to wear a frock to the floor, and I'm not going to wear it off the shoulder. So I got to thinking, so I lied prone, and I kind of, like, thought, what would you wear? I was due at 5 o'clock. So I wore a cocktail afternoon cocktail party dress with the black sheath and the white peplum and little glass slippers and the little white gloves and this black hat with the ostrich feathers. And that worked out apropos for the time o' day. That's a joke. O' day. Terry. Hello, Terry, are you there? Yeah, that's what happened, love.
Oh, yep. Goodness.
That was it.
Anita O'Day, recorded in 1987. She died last week at the age of 87. I'm Terry Gross.
I saw you last night and got that old feeling. When you came in sight, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. From Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology, capella.edu. And from Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year, at casey.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He became famous on Taxi. He directed War of the Roses, Hoffa, and Death to Smoochie. He produced Erin Brockovich and Pulp Fiction. On the next Fresh Air, Danny DeVito talks about his life and his eclectic taste. He's now starring in Deck the Halls. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.